I'd like to call the meeting to order. Do we have a quorum? Not yet? Okay. Okay. Welcome today to the meeting. I think we wanted to finish up the PowerPoint presentation from the other day. I think you had about one slide left, if I recall.
Madam Chair, there's one slide left on the workforce development.
Oh.
And then we do have a few slides on unemployment insurance, and I know they've been before the committee, so we can go through those relatively.
That'd be wonderful.
To get to the questions.
And could you identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Yes. I'm Mark Phillips, Commissioner of Deed, and I introduce.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Rick Caligiuri, and I'm an Employment and Training Director in the Workforce Development Division at Deed.
Thank you.
So Rick is going to go over the last slide. If you recall, the last slide that we went through was some of the changes we were from the governor's budget, and this is the last item that we need some language for changing.
Madam Chair and members, the final slide for workforce development has to do with monitoring pass-through grants. And this comes as a result of two things. Basically, the legislative auditor came out with a report recently or within the last couple of years on grants, what we like to call pass-through appropriations.
Could I just interrupt for just a second? We do have a quorum now, so I'll call the meeting to order. Thank you. Sorry.
So kind of based on the findings from the legislative auditor's report on pass-through appropriations and how they're administered and how they're monitored, and then some legislation that happened after that, there was a bill, I think, in the House. It was sponsored by Representative Norton that was passed that required Deed to make recommendations on administering and monitoring pass-through grants. And basically the situation with pass-through grants is that they essentially, from a department perspective, are an unfunded mandate. And in the situation with Deed and other agencies as well, in workforce development, the vast majority of our funding is federal funding, and we are not allowed to use federal funds to monitor. So we basically have this situation where we don't have funding to be able to provide the oversight and monitoring of pass-through grants. And so as a result of that, we have recommended this change item, which asks for 5% of funds on pass-through grants so that we can provide oversight and monitoring of these grants.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm going to bring up Keith Goodwin, the Director of the Unemployment Insurance Program.
Welcome, Mr. Goodwin. Could you identify yourself and proceed?
Keith Goodwin, Director of the Minnesota Unemployment Insurance Program. I'll be brief. I had the privilege of speaking to you quite extensively about a month ago. As you will see from the slide up there right now, which is slide 26 in your package, is all of our funding for unemployment insurance is federally funded. So there are no general operating funds, general funds from the state of Minnesota. And you'll see Federal's 118, there's a special revenue. What that is we are authorized to collect when we have an applicant who has a fraud penalty because they collected benefits they weren't entitled to via fraud, we can assess interest against them, and that interest goes into an account which we can use to further detect fraud, and that's what that is on a two-year biennium, $900,000 is what we anticipate. I won't repeat the rest of the slide. Then we go to customer service. I'm really not going to repeat this. We had extensive discussions about this 5 weeks ago, and I would say one thing, though. When you see the $2.8 billion on the top of that slide, it's about $1.2 $4 billion was funded by Minnesota employers last year. The remainder was funded by the federal government. So it's a lot of it is funded by the federal government, all the extensions. If you go to the next slide, and I might have intimated this a month ago, our trust fund balance is obviously significantly negative. It's as of Saturday of this immediate past week, it's $620 million negative, but we expect that in the spring as we have high payouts, we don't get receipts. But at the year end of last year, we were 2010, excuse me, we were a negative $544 million. And to give you a flavor, we thought a year ago we'd be negative $707 million. So we're about $160 million better. $544 is not good, but we're better than what we thought we were going to be a year ago. And we're looking at those projections again because we believe, as you saw on Tuesday, on the general tax collections, we think that payouts are going to be less than we anticipated. You probably saw the unemployment rate yesterday announced at 6.7%, which is the lowest since, I believe, December of 2008. So not good, but better than it has been over the preceding 2 years. We expect to be solvent by the end of 2013. We think it might be a little faster than that once we get our take another look at the projections, and I think that's good information for us. Then we have a UI contingent account, and the funding for the UI contingent account is primarily interest assessed against employers when they fail to pay taxes on time. There are a few other things that cause it, but the primary thing is interest. There's some fees and penalties as well. And that that contingent fund does not, even though the legislation might say it goes, the underlying fundamental legislation a long time ago says it goes for UI administration. It hasn't gone for UI administration for quite some time. A portion of that goes to the Workforce Development Fund for some very important things, primarily serving workforce development, workforce development and dislocated workers. Very critical need. Ran out of funds last year to serve that very important group, and then the rest of it gets transferred to the general fund. So, and that's done usually by session law. And that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Scalzi?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And why are we transferring it to the general fund from the workforce development fund?
Well, I think that was just a decision that was made that, you know, I don't want to speak on behalf of the legislature on that, but I think there was a feeling that those funds were needed to help balance the budget.
Mr. Soderberg, I guess you can answer the question.
Madam Chair and members, actually, this transfer is not coming from the Workforce Development Fund. This is coming from the UI contingent account going to the Workforce Development Fund. So the Workforce Development Fund will be receiving money under this proposal that it would otherwise not have. So, and we traditionally have done this in session law. I think it started back in about 2000. Every year typically it's the first $1,450,000 goes to the Workforce Development Fund with the remainder going to the general fund. In this case, it's the Workforce Development Fund will be receiving more than what has typically been the case.
Representative Scalzi.
Mr. Chair, then I guess my question would be, why are we taking money from the UI contingent account and transferring it to the general fund? Because I understand it's just going through there, but it is eventually ending up at the general fund, and I hear what you say to balance the budget, but then shouldn't the budget be balanced by every taxpayer in the state rather than just those who pay unemployment insurance?
Mr. Goodwin, would you like to answer, or should Mr. Soderberg?
I think I'd let Mr. Soderberg answer.
Thank you.
He doesn't have a vote.
I'll give the facts. I can't speak to you know, the merit or if it's meritorious or not meritorious. But the facts are that back in 2000, this fund basically was used as a add-on to administration in the UI fund. It's from the penalties that are assessed, mainly from the penalties that are assessed within the collection of the fund, some non-payment fraud, whatever. And this was basically a administrative fund that that supplemented the regular administrative fund. And the thought was is that it's not coming from all employers, it's coming from those fraudulent employers, and it would be for the it went to the general fund of the work, and the split was between the Workforce Development Fund and the general fund. That's the facts.
Okay, Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you may have answered this at that very extensively questioned meeting, and I just can't remember if you did. The number that we are negative or have gone down to negative, in past recessions, have we exceeded that number negative, or is this the most deepest number we've ever, kind of characterize that if you would, please.
in the 1982 recession, if my memory serves me correctly, and I wasn't doing this at that time, I think we ended up, I want to say, around 300 and some million in deficit, which correspondingly speaking, given the size of the economy and the wages, was actually higher than it is now. It's not a raw number the same, but of course that's 28 years ago. So this negative is a little bit less, comparatively speaking, than we were in 82. Okay.
Any other questions on this subject? Okay. We'll open it up for any other questions for the commissioner.
All of these?
Yeah. Representative Paymar.
Commissioner, I have a question on the JobZ program.
Okay.
I guess the question would be is how much... I don't know if you can answer this, but it would be information that I would like. On an annual basis, how much revenue is, I guess, lost to the state and to counties and local units of government through the tax subsidies through the JobZ program?
It looks like we have somebody else.
Madam Chair, I'm going to introduce Paul Moe. He's the Deputy Commissioner at DEED, has a little bit of history in this area.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, Paul Moe, Deputy Commissioner for the Department, Representative. I don't have the exact number, and I don't have it broken down by taxing jurisdiction, but I can get that in terms of the property tax and the sales tax and income tax kind of breakdown. We can provide that. I need to get that from revenue, but can
Madam
share that.
Chair. Mr. Modi,
Representative Paymar.
You don't have no approximate number of...
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's $33 million for the last year that we measured that, I believe.
And Madam Chair and Commissioner, is or Mr. Moe, is it the intent? I'm looking at the budget sheet, so it looks like the Dayton administration wants to continue the JobZ program.
Commissioner Phillips.
I don't believe that the Dayton administration has proposed any changes at this time to JobZ in his budget, but he hasn't dismantled it as well. I think that's a discussion that we intend on having with the committee. I know Representative Gunther has talked to me about working together on trying to see if there's any changes that would be beneficial. So.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I know saw Representative Howes raised his hand there. I mean, is it to this point? Because I have a few other questions on this, but I on JobZ, and I don't
Howes
know if you want
to. Madam Chair, it was once the first point question you asked. It was to that. I might as well ask the question that I'm done. When you bring the information for what we've lost in the revenue, would you tell us how much we've gained by creating the jobs and that revenue?
Madam Chair, yes, we can provide that as well.
Commissioner, I understand you're new, and Mr. Moe, I don't know if I'm new to this committee, and I assume that at some point you had discussion, Mr. Chair, about the legislative auditor's report in 2008 that found that the I just want to read a couple of these off to you because I think it's not only damning of the program, but also of DEED in its lack of oversight over the program. But the legislative auditor says that the program has not been focused on the goals of economic development. Has been used to provide tax breaks to some businesses that would have expanded in Greater Minnesota without JobZ. They also go on to say that there are significant problems with the program administration, particularly business subsidy agreements, which too frequently lack adequate job and wage requirements. It says that some businesses were removed from the JobZ program and have not had to repay any property tax breaks and have continued to receive subsidies for time following their removal from the program. On and on and on. It talks about how JobZ published the overstates the impact of the program in statistics post on its website. DEED credited the JobZ program with the creation of 5,400 new full-time jobs at the end of 2006. However, after they reviewed the reports, it suggested that the increase was about 20% lower. So it just goes, and I philosophically have had a problem with the JobZ program. I understand the intent of trying to provide an economic boost in greater Minnesota, but, you know, we've had story after story after story of a business who ends up in one of these enterprise zones, sometimes not even because of need, and are not paying property taxes, not paying sales taxes, not paying income taxes, and then another business that's producing the same product in another county and is not eligible for it is paying all of those taxes. So there's a fairness question here, and there's and then there's this report that says it's not working, and then thirdly, there's a report that says DEED has not been accountable in making sure that the program is running effectively. So there's sort of a lot of questions, and I don't know if you're prepared to answer it at this point, but I think in at this time during with a $5 billion deficit that this state is facing, I would hope that the Dayton administration would get rid of the whole program, or at least carve it up, start over, and find some ways to make it more accountable and make it truly needs-based if it's going to remain an economic incentive for greater Minnesota. I realize I might differ with some of my colleagues here, but those are my views, and I intend on introducing a bill that would do away with the whole program. Whether it gets a hearing or not, we'll see.
Did you want to respond to that?
Madam Chair, my response, I guess, would be that my conversations with Governor Dayton was that to improve JobZ and to work with the committees on improving JobZ to get to deal with the issues of the legislative audit report, mm-hmm. and to try to make it more effective. There's been talk about killing it and then coming back with one with a new name, and he said, I'm more interested in results than new names. So, you know, because my impression was he wanted to get rid of it. But he said, I'd rather have something that's effective, so if we can change it to become more effective. And that's just a verbal conversation with the governor. He didn't put anything in his budget about eliminating it, because there's some authority left under the current law, I believe, through 2015. So we thought, if those resources are available, can we improve the process to utilize that authority? Because DEED has been continuing to have declining resources to work with over the years, so we're trying to hang on to the resources we can and use them wisely, though.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymar, there are some glaring discrepancies between funding between Greater Minnesota versus rural Minnesota and vice versa. We spent a lot of money in the Met Council. We have market value tax credit problems. We have transit levy problems that we're helping pay for the metro area. So we can go in there and say, I got you all day long, and I'm ready to do that if you are. But the thing that I want to do is I want to have a job zone that actually covers the whole state. We're the only one that carved out any part of the state, only state that did that. And this has been a successful program in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and other places. So to say that the metro area doesn't have pockets of places that are hurting is a gross, gross misstatement. And I'm saying when we first had JobZ, it functioned very well for Greater Minnesota. Unfortunately, Governor Plenty did not include the whole state, and I think that was a gross error. And I think as far as the legislative auditor's report, he primarily functioned on breach of contract, which means that they might have said they were going to have 100 employees, they had only had 80. And I totally agree, that was wrong. It should be clawed back. There is a contract with the state of Minnesota. I think if I can get something passed, it will have, if they say they're going to have 100 and they only have 80, they get 80% of the benefit. And that's the way it should be. So I think it's a good tool. If you don't believe me, listen to Wisconsin right across the border. They say that this is one of the only job incentive program that they feared, and they rejoiced when it was neutered. So we can go tit for tat as long as you want.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar.
I don't remember Representative Gunther that there was any conflict here about programs that help the metro area or rural Minnesota. I stated at the beginning that this was the intent of it was to help areas. I thought in distress in greater Minnesota, although it sounds like that has not always been the case. I guess the issue is, if it's going to be reformed, if it's possible, you know, when the report says that 19% of the participants in the JobZ program would have expanded to the same extent in greater Minnesota without JobZ assistance, in addition, another 50% would have expanded to some extent without tax breaks. You know, we can have this sort of state by state arms race in terms of who can provide more incentives to business and industry. You know, that's the way. Ever since I've been here, that's been an issue. How can we, more incentives? But the fact is, when you provide those incentives, other people are paying for them, and so. I didn't mean to monopolize this whole discussion with Deed on JobZ, but I just think that I'm hopeful that the Dayton administration will look seriously at the recommendations that were made and by the legislative auditor, and if the program still has merits continuation, then that's fine. But what I read here is that it's been a gross failure, and that Deed's oversight has been really sloppy. And I think we need to correct it, and I think there's a fairness question here that needs to be addressed.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. I plan on addressing the fairness issue. I plan on satisfying the legislative auditor as well as the Department of Finance before I even offer a bill to do that.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't think anyone would ever say I've been a good friend of JobZ. But I will say, with the auditor's report, the tax chairs attempted to fix that over the last couple of years. There are some other things that have to be done. I'd love to lay blame at the past Commissioner of Economic Development, but what I know from this particular program, and have spent a couple of years fighting it, more than a couple of years fighting it, I would lay it more at revenue, because the intent of JobZ was, as it was passed, and I fought it tooth and nail, was to have a cafeteria plan where Deed could say, you get this tax break, but none of these others over here, and you get these two here. And revenue basically said, the way we wrote the bill, if you get one, you get them all. So it became much more problematic. And I think when we wrote the bill, we didn't know about the clawbacks. I hope if we go back into this, if I remember right, didn't we do clawbacks in the last session? But JobZ is problematic, but I don't want to see our Department of Economic Development have one more tool taken away from it at this particular time. So if we can figure out a way to improve it, I'm sure Representative Paymar is pretty sharp with a pencil. I watched him last year in a couple of his committees, so you guys will work real well together on that one.
Thank you.
Yes,
Representative.
I'll look forward to working with Representative Paymar, and he was a member of this committee at one other time.
Thank you. I have a question. Regarding on slide 9 with the angel tax credits, I believe you said something about 27 or so percent of those tax credits went to companies from out of the state. Could you expand on that, and did any go outside of the country?
Madam Chair, 25% of the investors are from non-Minnesota. All the investments have been in Minnesota. There's some been investors from not in Minnesota making investments.
Madam Chair, bringing outside investment into the state, we thought that was a...
That is a good idea. I just wanted to expand on that. So, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was curious, in your employee status, I believe you have some current positions you're interviewing for or hiring for. if you could help build a bigger picture for me to get a hold of, are they? I understand we're paying them some of those through federal funding, and I'm wondering if you can say, are you hiring more people, and is it coming from your general funds or is it coming from federal funding?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't believe we are requesting any or adding any positions. We might be filling vacant positions. I'm looking at, though, having said that, Madam Chair, Representative, we are looking at the whole organization. Mm-hmm. Are we structured, at least in my opinion, I guess, are we structured the best way to manage deed? And so I'm looking at everything before I do any hiring. And so we've left some positions that have been vacant through early retirements, people leaving, things like that, so that we have some boxes to move around if we decide to restructure slightly. And when I say restructure, I don't think dramatically, just putting some the right people in the right boxes and things like that. But we don't have any resources to have any additional staff. I wish we did, but we don't.
Right.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, could I comment on that? Yes. Representative, our headcount today is about 1,800 staff. We're about 90% funded through federal funds. Our peak employment was 1,870, I believe, and that's been dropping. And partly that was because of the stimulus money from a couple years ago. We've added some staff, and now those dollars are running out, and we're contracting again.
Representative Stensrud.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's very helpful. Walk me through a scenario, because I honestly don't know the answer to this. If you would fill a couple of positions or a handful of positions, and you say 90% of your funding comes from the feds, and I suspect in the future we'll probably get reduced funding from the feds, the way things seem to be going. Where does that leave us in terms of a liability on the state with regard to retirement, pensions, health care benefits? If we lose federal funding, are we sort of on the hook as a state then, and can we downsize? If we get downsized from the federal funding, can we downsize our workforce? Is that a fair question?
Madam Chair, Representative, I better not guess at the answer to that. That might be someone from MMB that could answer from a state perspective in terms of the impact and the federal-state relationship.
But, okay. Well, Madam Chair, I would comment, and correct me if I'm jumping out off of the bus here, but I would think if resources aren't available in certain budgets due to federal cutbacks, I think that's might be your point.
Right.
We have contracted when federal money, I mean, the stimulus is a prime example. They've added people for when there was stimulus money available, and we've contracted when they're not. So, I mean, it doesn't prevent us from eliminating jobs, and my gut feeling is if pensions are funded, they're usually funded through contributions, and if the position stops, the contribution stops. So I'm trying to get my arms around where you're trying to go with that, I guess.
Yeah. But
Madam Chair. Are you done? Mm-hmm. Representative Stensrud.
Yeah, no, I wasn't going anywhere. I'm not looking for any you know, bad guys here. I was just trying to get a feel for that, because I know so oftentimes the federal funding goes away and we're left with mandates oftentimes, whether that be full-time people we've staffed up for, and then we're sort of left holding the bag as a state level, and we don't want to go down that road too often.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And it isn't necessarily for the deed, Commissioner, but it might be. I mean, I had brought up at our last committee meeting the Workforce Development Fund. And as I see what some of the proposals are, or maybe they are, there would be cuts in general fund, but no cuts to the Workforce Development Fund funding of the pass-through grants for these really great programs that we have. When do we as a committee decide how we approach this through the tax committee? Because as I understand it, they're in the process of preparing their bill, and if we intend to increase the workforce development tax on businesses, we're going to have to do it pretty soon because it sunsets June 30th of 2011, the extra tax that was levied for this year. And if we're going to keep these programs funded by that method, we're going to have to increase that tax because it sunsets. So when do we go to the tax committee with these types of proposals?
Representative Gunther?
Well, the Workforce Development Fund is, as you know, an add-on to the unemployment insurance based on so much per full-time employee. And that raising or lowering of that fund is completely at the discretion of the commissioner. If he feels that we need to raise that because they're going to be short of funds, I believe that's the case. Is that correct?
Commissioner Phillips.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, I believe it's a the interpretation of that is can be a little bit ambiguous. So I just want to say I believe I have the authority to move that in a certain range.
Mm-hmm.
Now the governor's budget proposes that it goes back to the 0.1, I believe. 0.1. It's been at 0.12, and so the budget we've presented here is allowing it to go back to the 0.1. We have not proposed it to be increased or asked for any authority to have it increased. So it's going to go back to the 0.1 if the governor's budget was accepted.
Representative Gunther?
And I believe it's true also that about 50% of it goes to the workforce centers for basically single or small layoffs. And a lot of the other funds are kept for large layoffs that we have trainers in the state, various organizations, Teamster Service Bureau. I can see here right now that you do a very good job. When we have mass layoffs of taking those people and helping them hone their skills and write their resumes and get jobs pretty quickly.
Okay. Representative Clark.
Well, thanks. Since we're talking about that, you know, it might be helpful to have some quantification of what that 0.2% decrease would cost in terms of jobs. And I don't know that you have that on your handy.
Sure. No, I don't
have expect you do.
My head, no.
But I think that is data that we should have,
yeah.
Because you know we haven't been talking about cutting jobs in this committee and in this fund, and if we're going to do that, and that's the governor's proposal, we're going to cut jobs. Production, and so I'd really like to see if we couldn't quantify that.
Okay, I'm sure they can get that for you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. It wouldn't be a cut to the Workforce Development Fund because currently there was a one-year increase to it. It's been at 0.1 for the first 27,000 of an employee with a slight increase last year to 0.12, but that was just a one-time increase.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Ms. Scalzi, you probably know this, but I was the author of the original legislation that created that fund. We were first in the country, and I'm not sure there's any other that quite has it. It's been such a good investment in our dislocated workers, and some of the people in the beginning who opposed it became around. It became a very bipartisan approach throughout the state because everyone had layoffs. And so I just want to say it's been up and down. It's not just been one time that it's been done. It's been changed because of need.
That's right.
And That's just an important thing to know. If we don't have help for people who need skills to be retrained, that costs us something. They're not producing in the community like we need them to be, and they're going on to other kinds of public funding. So I think there is a cost, and that's what I'm asking if we could just try to quantify that. And I think maybe it would be helpful. There is a historical, probably Representative Scalzi, we could get the history of how that's gone up and down over the years.
I think Representative Gunther wanted to say something.
Yeah, Representative Scalzi, I think what the governor did is he let the contingency fund go up and lowered the dislocated workers' fee go down to 1. And I think that makes up for the money we needed. Is that correct, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, I believe that's the case.
So
I think, Mr. Soderberg, do you have something you might want to share on this or not? No, you're okay. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Scalzi.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Chair. I would just like to clarify because it did go up to 0.12 last year for 1 year only, but when you look at the history of the Workforce Development Fund, there are 14 programs in here that were formerly funded by the general fund. And one by one, the creep has come, possibly because of lack of general fund dollars. So rather than having everybody in the state pay for these great programs, and I agree they're great programs, instead we have begun levying a tax only on businesses that pay unemployment insurance. So there's a creep here. There's 14 programs that were previously general fund that are now workforce development fund. And as we're cutting the general fund, the tendency would be to find another source of money that nobody's looking at, because it's a hidden, silent tax that a lot of people don't know about. I only know about it because I pay it. And so it makes a big difference to me. And these are wonderful programs that should be supported by everyone in the state of Minnesota. That's my only point. And I don't want to see more and more programs creep onto the Workforce Development Fund.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Representative Scalzi. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about perhaps the Biobusiness Alliance, the Life Science Alley, the science, was it the bill, Representative Mahoney? Science and Technology Authority. It seems like, thank you, most of the rest of the world, this is their primary focus on driving jobs, driving their economies. You know, I guess my first general question is, you know, how big of a priority is it really to see us kind of move in this direction, be a leader? I know we talked a lot about the state of North Carolina deciding 15, 20 years ago that this is the direction they were going to go in, and now we're in their shadows. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about if this area is a priority and kind of what we are doing to really help move Minnesota forward in that area.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, this is one of my priorities. When I first met with the governor to see if we were aligned, if I was interested in this job, I told him the technology transfer, finding resources for startups, early stage venture capital, all these things are things that I had great interest in and had some history and experience in. So I think over the long run, I mean, this is a challenging thing to get this budget through, but I'm trying to preserve what resources we have in business and community development to work in this arena. So this is right up my alley. I've spent quite a bit of time with Representative Mahoney talking about different things. You know, the governor's budget, it was a tough budget to put together, and so we tried to preserve what we could in there for those advocacy groups. But, you know, they have support from industry as well. And I think partnering with industry in this arena to, you know, to produce incubation space and early stage capital, R&D money, that kind of thing is something that I'm going to be working on a lot.
Representative Sanders.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for that answer. It's encouraging. How does a business that may be looking to move in that direction, how do they find you? How do you find them? If you know they're looking to be looking for incubation space, if they're looking to be the next, you know, DOD contractor, how do they find you? How do you find them?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders. Well, we do work with those advocacy groups. For example, you mentioned Life Science Alley. By supporting them, we actually physically work with them, too. We attend trade conferences and things. In fact, anecdotally, the BioVest announcement in the rotunda last week, Deed met BioVest at a conference in Atlanta 2 years ago and found out that they had a presence in Minnesota, but they were looking to expand their vaccine business into Florida. And we said, well, could we work with you and take a closer look at Minnesota? And we ended up landing that with relatively modest resources and incentives to have that expansion end up in Coon Rapids. And it's a relatively modest expansion at this time, but if they get their FDA approval, it would literally be hundreds of jobs. So, and just another anecdote is I met with a volunteer president, again, get the name volunteer president of the UEL laboratory over at the university campus today, who their space is about 90% booked up, and most of their lab space, I want to say, and maybe Representative Mahoney knows this better than I do, is probably 100% leased up. So there is a market out there for incubation space for things. And again, the second thing in my list of the three things I wanted to work with the government on is access to capital, period, for small business in general, not only startups, but for existing businesses. So these are that, and just, again, connecting with the business community were like the three of my priorities, I guess. So.
Thank you, and Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What if you could tell me, what are some of the differences between the BioBusiness Alliance, Life Science Alley, Science and Technology Authority? I want to make sure that we are doing everything we can, but if it makes sense to have two funds versus three funds, does it, you know, are they entirely going at different areas in the markets? You know, I guess, what are some of the differences or similarities to help us make sure we're getting, being the most efficient and the most effective, trying to really push Minnesota to be a leader?
I'm going to take Madam Chair, or Mr. Chairman, back in the gavel, Representative Sanders. I'm going to be a little bit vaguer on the difference between bioscience. I think that there are different industry groups got behind these different trade organizations. So if you have the life science group and maybe the biobusiness group, slightly different. But what the difference between that and the Science and Technology Authority is, Science and Technology Authority was actually created to raise funding, state funding, which they haven't done yet. I think they're attempting to do some this year, to help with dollars for early stage companies to do research, to find interns, to, you know, generally promote the science and technology industry. So I would see the advocacy groups like BioBusiness Alliance, like the Life Science Group, to work with our Science and Technology Authority to look for resources. So it's advocacy. It's almost like the difference between the Chamber of Commerce being an advocacy group and maybe DEED that's providing resources to help business. Okay. You know, looking at the two.
Excellent. Well, Mr. Chair, I just encourage us to continue down this path. This is something that's really important, I believe, to the state of Minnesota, this area of industry in particular. I've seen some companies that have been approached by other states with very nice offers, and I'd like to see Minnesota be you know, our country and world's leader in this industry. So,
Before I call on Representative Mahoney, I would like to point out that Medtronic, not too long ago, lost 2,000 jobs, and that was one of the things that we have to guard for. And with that, Representative Mahoney.
Well, before I I'd like to expand on what Representative Sanders was saying, but I always look at the 2,000 jobs lost as an opportunity right now. We have a lot of smart people looking for something to do. Hopefully they will start their own small life science, medical device companies. You asked if I may, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner, this is something that I've been following for a long, long time. So if I can just a little bit more. The Science and Technology Authority is a promotion. It is the umbrella group, so to speak, that looks at, as was spoken to Tuesday, the low-hanging fruit. We've not done a very good job over the last many years under different leadership and varieties of other things of grabbing that low-hanging fruit. Science and technology is, and it's very broad spread. It's looking to expand in all areas of the science-based stuff in Minnesota. Great term, science-based stuff. But it covers, we have a variety of clusters, computers and sensors and controls, some robotics, life science. We're pretty advanced in our alternative fuels, particularly in solar. The BioBusiness Alliance, if you really want to know where they're trying to get to, the summary of their Destination 2025 gives you a pretty easy read. I think it's 10 pages at the most. BioBusiness Alliance is a very focused group working on two or three different areas with some expansion into some of the others, because there is, at this day and age, many of these companies, like the gentleman that was here on Tuesday, He talked about landing pilotless drones. But that's really the first step to miniaturizing some of that stuff and actually going inside the human body and finding out how the heart got damaged in the heart attack and actually having a picture of it so they know where to put the stem cells to repair that muscle tissue so that you don't go back into the hospital and you don't have to be on the drugs. That's where... So BioBusiness Alliance kind of helps them. Science and technology also helps them because of the funding and some of the synergies that they're trying to do and bring people to it. It's you don't want to cannibalize, and I had a conversation with the commissioner, we don't want to cannibalize one for the other. There's three different areas that we're trying to go in the state because there's thousands of jobs. And there's a lot of pipes to weld when you make those jobs. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait a minute. I didn't say that.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you can point to me. It might be in this book somewhere. If you could help point where. I'm looking for maybe an org chart or showing where some of the regional offices are. In particular, in the Workforce Development Division, we've got like the workforce centers across the... across the state. We also have WDD systems coordination, and we've got regional administrators. And I'm wondering, are those in the same offices as the workforce centers? And also the vocational rehabilitation services. Are those all in different offices and in different cities, or is there some overlapping there? And is that somewhere in my big book?
Mr. Chair and members, there are 49 full-service workforce centers throughout the state. Mm-hmm. They represent a state-local partnership, and to varying degrees, there are, I mean, if you look at Minneapolis, there are primarily state staff. You can go to other workforce centers across greater Minnesota and find primarily local staff. Mm-hmm. But the primary partners are job service and vocational rehabilitation, as well as the local partners representing Workforce Investment Act programs. Regional administrators are normally located or would office at one of those workforce centers in their region. That's the infrastructure. Again, it's a state-local partnership. There are workforce centers that are primarily all locally funded with local staff, primarily.
Okay.
It's a local decision.
Commissioner, I think you can continue now. If you got anything else to bring up. If you have anything else to report, we're all ready for it.
No. Thank you very much.
We appreciate you
being
here.
Look forward to working with the committee on getting to the final number. Thank you.
There you go. We're looking forward to it. With that, we're waiting for housing. Right?
Yep.
We're waiting for housing to come down. Did anybody care to read the minutes of March 1st? I'm sure you did.
I did, and I was here, and I would move their approval.
Okay. Representative Scalzi moved to approve the minutes of March 1st. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
What can I get this out?
Where's your...
Oh, you got it. Good. Thank you. All right. Certainly.
I am.
Yeah, typical. Let's go.
Yep, there's the phone.
Welcome, Commissioner Thingathall.
Did you want it?
Thank you, Chair.
Good to have you here. I think the noise is starting to wane now, so we can get to listen to the wonderful story you have to tell.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've decided in the interest of time to not put the presentation up on the screen, so you have copies in front of you, and for those in the audience, there are copies at the back. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Are we ready to start?
Proceed, please.
Thank you very much. We're here today to talk about the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And we are a state agency that finances and advances affordable housing opportunities for low and moderate income Minnesotans. And we do that to both enhance the quality of life for those people, but most importantly to foster strong communities. And for those of you who may not be familiar with the agency, I think you'll find as we go through the presentation that the agency with its 40-year history has done significant activity in each of your districts. And we're happy to be here today to talk with you about our budget request and how we would propose to utilize those funds over the next 2 years. If I can ask you to move to slide number 3 called Strategic Priorities. The agency has 4 strategic priorities that are advanced by the budget areas, and because it sometimes gets a little confusing as to the budget categories versus the actual activity that's going on, we've tried to provide you on slide number 3 with a summary of our key strategies, and then underneath that are the descriptions from the budget document that are included within that activity. So we will go over each of those sections in just a moment, but what we'd like to do, if I could have you turn to slide 4, we'd like to give you a few highlights of the accomplishments of the Housing Finance Agency over the last year, as well as showing you the distribution of where those dollars have gone, then go into the budget program areas, and finally to discuss the budget in as much detail as we have time for. My background, I've been with the agency for all of a month, and I started my career at the agency back in the mid-70s and spent 10 years there as the agency was getting its start as one of the premier housing finance agencies in the nation. There are 2 particular tools that are used by housing finance agencies today across the country that tend to not show up in state budgets, but are incredibly important tools for the production of affordable housing opportunities. The first are tax-exempt revenue bonds, and that's our primary tool for providing mortgages for first-time home buyers. You'll see something on statistics for that in a few minutes. And the second is called the low-income housing tax credit. That allows us to produce rental housing that's produced by private developers in the private market. I have had significant experience with both of those in the private sector outside of the Housing Finance Agency, and am delighted to be back at the agency where I started my career to bring that experience back to, I hope, use a relatively small number of appropriated dollars to really result in dramatic impact for Minnesotans and for all of you. Minnesota Housing is a little bit unique in its management and control in that it is the control is vested in the members of the Minnesota Housing Agency Board by statute, and both the board and the commissioner are appointed by the governor. If I can have you turn to slide 5 for a moment. Here we're looking at 2010 highlights. This agency provided last year assistance to more than 72,000 households, totaling more than $700 million. That included some of the federal stimulus dollars in this cycle. That breaks down at about $400 million for 46,000 rental units and about $300 million for 26,000 either home buyers or home owners. Specifically in the activities, about 12,000 new affordable units, that's not necessarily new buildings, could be substantially rehabilitated buildings, preserved about 4,500 units of existing affordable housing, addressed homelessness, assisting more than 12,000 households, and addressed foreclosure issues, foreclosure prevention and mitigation, with about 13,000 households. So all in all, really touching an important targeted group of Minnesotans with the variety of programs. If I can have you turn to page 6 for a moment. This shows a pie chart of our 2010-2011 affordable housing plan, which we're just wrapping into the last portion of. And I want to point out particularly that state appropriations make up a small but very crucial part of that overall spending plan. As you can see, bond proceeds make up about 44%. That's our tax-exempt revenue bonds that we have the authority to issue. Federal resources, including rent subsidies, low-income credits, et cetera, about 33%. And agency resources that are recycled dollars make up about 15%. So we do believe that we take a relatively small number of dollars, use the fact that the agency has, over the last 40 years, built up a very favorable credit rating, so we're able to access the credit markets at very advantageous rates and make the most of leveraging those state-appropriated dollars. One might ask, well, how are you doing with those homeowners who are borrowing those loans, and how do you compare to other homeowners who've suffered in the foreclosure crisis? I do want to point out that all of our mortgages are 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. All of our home buyers are required to have home buyer counseling, and our foreclosure rate is about 1%. As compared to, for similar mortgages, about 3%, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association data. If I could have you turn to page 7. We deliver virtually all of the assistance that's provided by the Housing Finance Agency through a network of private delivery partners. This is very much about utilizing the strong businesses in Minnesota to provide these resources. And what that means is that all of our single-family mortgages are not originated by the agency, but rather are originated by banks and mortgage bankers located all over the state. That's 77 partners with almost 800 branches covering the state. We also have 112 home improvement loan lenders that participate in our programs. We rely on units of local government to help us with planning various resources and delivering them as well. There are really three ways that people get access to our dollars. One is loans to individuals. The second is applications from developers that we might accept on an ongoing basis. And for the most scarce resources, we run a competitive application process through requests for proposals. One of the things that we were asked to talk about in preparation for this hearing was where we have particularly been an innovator as an agency in making sure that we're making effective and efficient use of state dollars. I'd like to cite an example of what we call the super RFP process. And what that means is that in most states in the country, when it comes to allocating federal and state resources, there are multiple application processes. So if I'm a housing developer that wants to put up a multifamily building, I typically have to go through 3, 4, 5, maybe even 6 application processes in order to assemble all the dollars that are needed to pull together a project. For a number of years in Minnesota, and Tanya will help me with how many years, we have had a combined application process that includes dollars from DEED, Met Council, Corrections, and two of our important private sector partners, the Family Housing Fund, which serves the metro area, and the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund that serves the Greater Minnesota. This process is well regarded by developers across the state and is recognized nationally as a best practice in affordable housing. And I can tell you, having worked recently in a national position, it is definitely the envy of housing developers from around the country. If I could have you turn to slide 8. We show you here how the assistance has been distributed around the state in fiscal year 2010, and that it it aligns very closely with the distribution of eligible households around the state. We don't have strict targets for how those dollars are allocated, but within all of our request for proposal processes, we take into account the location within the state in awarding those dollars. That's really the end of the overview. I'd like to have you turn to page 9, and this gives you a summary of our budget request for the fiscal year. We are looking, and that should be for fiscal year 12 and 13, sorry. We are requesting $77.1 million. That breaks down into five general categories, which we'll review with you in just a moment. We've tried to provide you on page 9 a quick cross-reference. The budget pages are listed along with the name that we give the program at the agency, together with, in the first column, the program area that is described in the budget document. We are frequently asked what that represents in terms of comparison to last year's base budget, and that's shown on slide number 10. So our base budget for fiscal year 10 and 11 was $82 million. So the budget before you represents a 5% base reduction. The changes are slightly different than just a straight 5%, because there is also a requested reallocation from what we call our challenge program, which is used primarily in development projects, to the Housing Trust Fund, which is used primarily in our programs to prevent homelessness. You see in the right-hand column that our recommendation to the governor, which he agreed to move forward in his budget, is that in the reduction it was not across the board, but rather we recommended that the three programs at the top of the list, which serve formerly homeless individuals, be held harmless, in other words, to stay at the same level, with the other programs somewhat higher cuts. And what our guideline was in making those cuts is that if there were other sources of funding that we thought could be brought to bear to make up some of that gap, we've given particular attention to making somewhat deeper cuts there. The Challenge Fund, which is used by communities around the state and by many of the parties that interact with the agency, we have made a determination that even at the reduced level, that we believe it can be used to support the full amount of federal resources, most importantly the low-income housing tax credit, so that we can still utilize that full amount of federal resource. Jumping to slide 11, we get into the detail of the individual programs. The first is our development and redevelopment program at $14.3 million. This is our highest leverage program, which leverages $7.30 for each $1 of state investment. It provides a variety of financing for both owner-occupied and rental households, and the target of the household that we're serving with these programs is about $35,000 to $60,000 median income. So this is where we provide housing for folks in your communities like teachers, police, and many moderate income professions. And again, this includes both home buyer and rental properties. Moving on to slide number 12, our homelessness prevention and supportive housing programs. Again, there are three programs: the Housing Trust Fund, which we use predominantly to provide rental assistance, the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program, which helps us to provide direct assistance through local governments and social service agencies, and our Bridges program, which is for those suffering from mental illness. I want to give you a few examples here of why we feel this program, which really came to its full fruition in the early years of the Pawlenty administration really does make sense from a budgetary standpoint, from a cost avoidance standpoint, achieved through savings in other service areas. I know you're going to face a lot of very tough budget cuts, and this is one where we think it really does make sense. Our Bridges program, for example, the rental assistance that we provide to the residents of supportive housing projects, the cost of that rental assistance is approximately $18 a day, and that compares to roughly $259 a day for those same individuals who might be forced to stay in a more institutionalized setting if they do not have this option of a supportive housing environment where they can get access not only to a roof over their head, but also to the social services that they need to return to a healthy, productive life. We work very closely with other departments of the state, corrections and human services, DEED, and I'm missing one, which Tanya can help me with. Public safety, thank you. And we have many other stories about the cost effectiveness. For example, our family homelessness prevention and assistance program, the average assistance to a family, and this is a program that helps families with just a small leg up in terms of something that they might need to move from a shelter into more permanent housing. The average assistance per family is about $650. $650. That compares to the cost of that family staying in the shelter of $90 a day. So it doesn't take too many extra days in a shelter where they're not able to move into permanent housing to make up that $650. We serve with this group the most vulnerable populations, and the median household income of people receiving assistance through our homelessness prevention programs is about $8,300 a year. That's household income. Moving to slide 13, we're very focused on outcomes of our homelessness prevention programs. And one of those outcomes that we are able to measure is that after 1 year, 87% of those that had been formerly long-term homelessness were still in the housing that they had moved to or had a positive exit from that housing, meaning moving to other housing, by the end of 1 year. 72% of the adults reported some type of disability, mental illness, with mental illness being most prevalent. And the incomes of those entering the housing, the supportive housing, increased for 32% of those households. So again, we do think that this is very much a cost avoidance set of programs, and one that also helps communities to decrease crimes on their street by removing homeless from the streets and temptation. Home ownership assistance on slide number 14 is probably the longest running program of the agency. It's also one of our smaller budget items that really leverages the ability of our tax exempt revenue bonds to serve a targeted group of households that is in the lower end of the moderate income scale. This program by law is required to be used by first-time home buyers. It is used by financial institutions to help them originate loans and to help home buyers get into housing more quickly and at slightly lower income levels. Our targeting has been very successful in that we are number one in the country among housing finance agencies at targeting these funds to those who need them the most. Just for a point of reference, our interest rate today that we're offering to first-time home buyers is 4.5%, just a little bit lower than market, but with the package of resources, including down payment assistance, we are able to serve those households who might not otherwise get access to a home. On slide 15 is our preservation program. There are two parts to that. It's our affordable rental investment fund for preservation with the acronym PARIF, and our rental loan program, which is predominantly an outstate program, Greater Minnesota program, that helps to improve rental properties in Greater Minnesota. Here again, our leverage is quite generous, with $5.70 being leveraged for every dollar of state assistance. Moving on to slide 16, relatively small program but important is resident and organizational support. Here again, we haven't cited the leverage, but these dollars are really used in collaboration with the National Foreclosure Mitigation Counseling Program and the HUD Counseling Program, and has been invaluable during the foreclosure crisis in being able to help many Minnesotans either stay in their homes or move on to other other housing opportunities following a foreclosure. These dollars are also used, very importantly, to assist communities in developing community plans that help to address homelessness and for them to, for local communities to develop their own homelessness prevention programs. On slide 17, that really concludes our detailed budget presentation, but I would like to point out that housing is well known as an engine for jobs. One of the reasons that the construction industry has been hardest hit among all industries in the last several years is because residential construction is down 40%. And the economic impact of Minnesota housing, as we've shown in a number of studies, is that for about every $1 million of Minnesota housing investment, 15 full-time equivalent jobs are created. Finally, on slide 18, we'd really like to leave you with the thought that Minnesota housing is a smart investment among the choices you have to make. There's a 40-year track record of success with outcomes similar to what we've talked about in fiscal year 2010. There are no state appropriations that are used for operating. All of the appropriated dollars go directly into programs. Investments are made in communities throughout the state through local businesses. That's local developers, local bankers, local mortgage bankers. Investments leverage public and private resources. Cost avoidance through our supportive housing programs are well documented and well warranted. We think that these small amount of state appropriations are vital to us being able to target these other private and federal resources to those most in need. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll hand it back to you.
Representative Paymar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forgot your name. I'm sorry.
Mary Tingerthal.
Tingerthal? I'm sorry. Ms. Tingerthal, I'm just curious. I just was trying to follow the budget book and your slide presentation at the same time, and I'm just wondering, under the slide 11, the under the development and redevelopment portion of your budget, that it talks about Minnesota receiving $40 million in stimulus money in 2009. So I'm just wondering, I'm assuming that money is not getting that anymore. So where did you, are you backfilling that portion of the budget someplace else? Are we cutting something? That's my first question. I have one final other question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the $40 million was the Neighborhood Stabilization Program funds, which was for foreclosure remediation efforts in neighborhoods that have been extremely hard hit by the foreclosure crisis. You're right. It's basically not ongoing funds. We are about to receive another $5 million for this program. So it's money that was used to acquire and rehab homes that were in foreclosure and then sold to new home buyers.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, you know, we've made a dent in foreclosure, but nowhere near to, I think, where you want to be. So what does this actually mean practically in terms of the loss of this funding for the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, one of the other activities that or programs that has funded foreclosure remediation is the Challenge Program. And we will still have some money to devote to foreclosure recovery efforts in the Challenge Program, even with the reductions that are proposed. In addition, I'll put in a little plug for our bonding proposal. We have a bonding request of $10 million for foreclosure remediation efforts for rental housing and home ownership in the form of community land trusts. So we're trying to use some state funds to help continue the efforts that were started or that were amplified with the neighborhood stabilization program.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't understand why you would reduce the Challenge Program if this is an area that is clearly in need and we're not getting the federal dollars.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, you know, unfortunately, the governor's recommendation was a 5% cut. We tried to carefully calibrate our reductions so that, as the commissioner said, so that we protected first the programs that served people with disabilities, people with extremely low incomes, people who are homeless. And then we tried to protect other programs that, to make sure that the Challenge Program is a prime example, to make sure that there was sufficient funding left to leverage other resources and at least continue some of the efforts on foreclosure remediation.
Representative Paymar?
I have one more, unless anyone, I don't want to be taking up.
Can't wait for your next.
Okay, this is an issue that's obviously concerned to me and probably Representative Mahoney, others in St. Paul, but I. The housing development that's proposed to around the central corridor. Can you just speak more to that? I mean, as you speak about it, you talk about it in the budget book. But the $50 million that went along for development on the Hiawatha line as well as the central corridor. So those are units that are up and running, or are those proposed developments?
Mr. Chair, with respect to the housing along Hiawatha, I think there might be one project that's still in the development stage, but the rest of them are up. With respect to Central Corridor, I think that all of those projects, I don't think there's any that are completed. I think those are all still in process.
I'd like to have that information at some point. Thank you.
Ms. Orr, would you give your name officially for the record?
Sorry, I'm Tanya Orr with the Housing Finance Agency.
Representative Weidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the down payment assistance program for first-time home buyers, is that when that money is paid back, how is that? Where does that money go?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it returns to the Home Ownership Assistance Fund to be used for additional down payment assistance for new first-time home buyers.
Okay. And just what is that fund look like? How much is granted out annually, and about how big is that fund?
Mr. Chair, please. If you'll give me just a minute, I can tell you exactly how much money was spent last year. $3.4 million was provided last in the federal fiscal year 10.
And then how much would be in that fund, Mr. Chair? Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a revolving fund, so monies come in and go out like almost continuously, because we're making mortgages on a daily basis. We're purchasing mortgages and making these deferred loans on a daily basis.
Okay. So go ahead, you don't mind.
Representative, are you asking what's the total that's outstanding
out there?
What is the total that is outstanding out there? Yes, but what is the total that's in the fund at any given time? And maybe you've already answered that. The 3.5 million is in the fund. But what? How much is outstanding then?
Mr. Chair, I think we'll have to get back to you with the total amount of outstanding loans under that program. It's a program that's been in existence for
35 years.
Yeah, 35 years. And obviously when houses are sold, the money comes back to us, but we'll have to get back to you with the total. The $3.5 million was just the amount that was dispersed in the last federal fiscal year.
Thank you very much. I'm just interested if there's a pot of money there that we can might be able to take a few million and bring it back into the general fund. Or always looking for little pockets of money, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate that very much.
You're welcome.
I think this money does revolve quite easily. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to point out, sort of reiterate a point that the commissioner made, that this is money that is coupled with the mortgage revenue bond proceeds to allow us to serve a different income level. I'm fairly certain when I get you the information, you'll see there's not a pot of money sitting there because the money goes out on a daily basis. But if this program were not funded, it would make it much more difficult for us to serve the income levels that we serve with the mortgage revenue bond program.
So you're telling me take my rating efforts elsewhere, is that what you're saying? Sorry.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question. You could help me. I got two areas I wanted to just ask on. On page 13, you talked about your ending long-term homelessness initiatives, which is great. Help me understand the goal for that, because it seems as though you provide loans and financing for homes. So is this homelessness initiative to actually get them into a home in which they own, or is this a different thing where we're providing them temporary housing? Are we giving them rent? Or if you'd help me understand that, that'd be great. And I was curious, what's the goal of that? That'd help me.
Ms. Orr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the goal is to try and provide sufficient permanent supportive housing for people who have been homeless for more than a year or multiple times in the course of 3 years, so that they are no longer homeless but have a place to live and have the services that they need to be successful. It is not to become homeowners. This is permanent supportive rental housing. So it is a combination of housing and supportive services. There are lots of national studies that have indicated that you need to have both of those together in order to be successful. And the goal is to have them have the services and the housing that they need, and that they will stay there. And that at least at this point, as the commissioner said, 87% of the people who have taken advantage of our housing and services have remained for a year. So that is an indication of the fact that people are coming from off the streets for a long time and are staying in housing in the community.
Okay. Representative Stensrud.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, is it a subsidy or is it 100% or is it 50% or is there some skin in the game in terms of do they have to make some kind of a payment?
In Mr. Chair, Representative, in virtually all of our programs, the residents that we're trying to serve are required to make some contribution. In the case of the rental assistance programs, households are required to pay 30% of their income for their rent. And then the subsidy is the difference between the cost of that housing and what they can contribute from their own income.
Okay. And then one follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Stensrud.
You could help me also on a different subject. You referred to the federal stimulus money. Mm-hmm. That's kind of not there anymore. $40 million, and then you mentioned some big words. You used it for foreclosure remediation and neighborhood stabilization. With $40 million, I'm wondering, what does that look like, and what did you actually do? Did you help pay off loans or refinance, how many neighborhoods did you stabilize? Or help me get a good picture of that.
Commission.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stensrud, I'm going to ask Tanya to get us a few numbers, but before we do that, I'll just talk about the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, which is a federal program that was actually passed before the stimulus and was in recognition of the fact that with the foreclosure crisis, there was a dramatic impact on many communities of the physical nature of vacant buildings, properties that oftentimes needed to be demolished, acquired and rehabbed, so that the physical impact of the of people losing their homes to foreclosure, sometimes homeowners, sometimes investors, was really affecting the other people on the block. So devastated neighborhoods like the east side of St. Paul, North Minneapolis, this was really to help stem the tide, if you will. And quite honestly, Minnesota was at the forefront of, I think, utilizing these dollars very effectively and very early because the dollars were concentrated in those areas whereby getting rid of a bad house or helping to rehab a house, you really could keep the people who were still there from feeling like they needed to move out. So those dollars were awarded by formula based on the level of foreclosures and the level of subprime lending. They were administered locally by local governments, and there was a oversight of those dollars by the Housing Finance Agency.
So, Representative, I'll get you the exact number. The homes that are being acquired and rehabbed are in process. So we haven't, not all of the work is completed. But we expect that there will be about at least 500 homes acquired and rehabbed, or in a few cases demolished, and so that room was made for new construction. In the first use of the money, then some of the money will come back, and we'll have another. We'll have more homes that will be assisted with this money. So it doesn't sort of end with the first the first round of activity. So I'll get you the exact number, but it's approximately 500 we expect for with the initial set of activities.
Representative Mahoney, to this point.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Stendard. I may end up with this a couple of these blocks in my district after next year, so I want to be really careful how I say this. Coming to the Capitol from my home, I have to go from east to west, and there were a couple, three blocks in particular that every week or every day that I drove by, I would count the number of blue stickers on the door, which were foreclosed properties. And last winter, there was one block had nine, one block had four, and another block I just didn't bother to count because I would get so frustrated. Actually, this year, there are no blue stickers on those streets now. So my fear, my biggest fear, is that this money is not going to be there for when this hits the suburban areas, which it's now heading towards. And that's going to be problematic. I want to compliment you on the job that you did on that. I mean, I don't know whether it was your agency or your agency in St. Paul's agency or whatever, but there's people living in those houses. Those blue stickers are off. Great job. I hope you, when you get hit with the suburban stuff, you can are able to do as great a job as you did in my city. So thank you very much. But that's what I think that money was going towards.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and kind of to that point as well. So the stimulus money, the $40 million, is one time, and then you said you're receiving a $5 million federal grant for 12-13. Is that correct? You said something about your...
Yeah, Mr. Sure. Chair, Representative Sanders, we're receiving, we should be signing the contract any day now for the $5 million for the what's called the Neighborhood Stabilization Program 3. And that will be, we have a couple of years to commit and disperse that money.
Mr. Chair, does that...
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that, is that like a budget category that you have, or is that just additional funds that you, I mean, do you have a stabilization? And I was just, I'm looking through your priorities, guided decisions. I'm just wondering which of these programs, I just don't see anything that says, you know, like neighborhood stabilization. Which of those programs would that fit under, if any, or is this a reserve or bonus type?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, it's actually, it fits in the category of development and redevelopment. And that's where the previous money was resided, I guess.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, one additional question on slide 14. I think this kind of goes back to Representative Leidiger's question, what he was trying to get at, in that the first bullet point was, and maybe I misunderstood the conversation, but homeownership assistance fund looks or sounded like it was a revolving loan fund. Is that correct? And if so, what is the purpose for the additional funds if that's the case?
Ms. Orr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, it is a revolving loan fund. We make loans, we make a couple of thousand loans each year to first-time home buyers. We don't get enough repayments because people tend to stay in their home more than a year or two. It actually takes about, it's, I think our average is about 9 years. So we're not getting repayments every, sufficient levels of repayments every year to provide the down payment assistance that's needed to, with the first-time homebuyer mortgages that we're making. So that's the point of the continued funding for that program, is to allow us to continue to serve additional first-time home buyers that we wouldn't be able to do if we were just operating with repayments alone.
Thank you.
We have Representative Murray, then Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if you could help me with a little clarification. I had the HRA contact me on some things, and you guys are the HFA, and they were talking about ending homelessness with their program, and they were also talking about a $10 million bonding request to rehab houses, and it sounds like we're doing the same thing. Or should we be working together here, or can you explain the differences so I can kind of understand? It sounds like you're doing a lot of the same things.
We actually do work very closely together, and it would be the dollars that, many of the dollars that came through the Housing Finance Agency that they would use locally to, for the homelessness programs. With regard to the $10 million request for public housing, this is a request that a number of the public housing the groups related to public housing, the housing redevelopment authorities, are asking to be sponsored, and it would be out of the complementary portion of the bonding bill. It is not a part of the governor's request in the bonding bill. We support that effort, but it would be a separate request from the bonding request that we have put forward for use in neighborhood stabilization.
Before we get to Representative Mulry, I'd like to mention that Representative Leidiger's got some students and constituents from Clearwater Middle School, and we want to welcome to our committee. Thank you for coming. And with that, Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Got a lot of questions, so I'm follow up some other time. But one of the ones right off the top, as I recall, HECAT was used for a while for foreclosure counseling, I thought, and then the feds gave us money. And did that go into this or into the Home Ownership Center? What funded them? Is that money still going to be there, or is that gone? I thought that was a not a permanent grant, but just a length of certain time. How are we going to fund all our foreclosure counseling, which is incredibly important? My area knows how extremely important it is, and the suburbs are going to be known real quickly the way things are going in the national predictions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, HECAT is in fact used for both home buyer counseling and foreclosure prevention counseling. We have received, Minnesota's received a sizable amount of money in several rounds for foreclosure prevention counseling from the federal government. It is not permanent funding, but I think we're on round four, and we expect to receive another roughly $3 or $4 million in the next couple of months. So that will take us at least through the end of the year to keep that. When we started getting the federal money, we expanded the network from about 20-some counselors to over 75 counselors. And so this will keep the network of foreclosure prevention counselors going for at least through the end of the calendar year. And that's sort of how we've been operating the last few years, is hoping that we'll get some more money. It is definitely going to be an ongoing need, and so far the federal government has recognized that and has stepped forward with assistance. Minnesota has received the second or third highest amount of money under that national counseling program in recognition of what a strong network and good program we have.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's just...
Mr. Mulry.
I'm worried about it running out because the records with that group that the Homeownership Center connects it's over 50% of the people that were going to lose their house, and they somehow get them to keep their house. So that's having a tremendous effect, and it's all over the state. So I don't know if we have a backup for that if the Fed's money doesn't come or what, because it's such a serious issue.
Mr. Chair, we don't have a total backup. We have been successful in getting contributions from the local philanthropic organizations, not obviously at the same level as the federal government, but that will be part of our plan if there's not a renewal of this funding.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, I thought there was other questions, but that's just fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Obama administration has made recommendations on Freddie and Fannie to go from very low down payment percentages to approximately 20%, and put into place or made recommendations on the abilities for banks to resell those loans. How is that going to affect the Minnesota Housing Agency, or is that something that's going to be thought about in a couple of weeks when we find out if that's actually going to happen?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Mahoney, I wish I knew the answer to that question. Mr. Geithner said this week when he testified before Congress, it's expected that the actual reformation of whatever replaces Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is probably at least 2 years out. We are certainly very concerned about what the impact will be on the ability of moderate income Minnesotans to become homeowners. And we expect to monitor very closely what the testimony is, what the plans are for remaking Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and to speak up loudly on behalf of Minnesota homeowners.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, just because we're very short on time, could you answer two questions? You mentioned moderate homeowners. Could you define for me and for the rest of the committee moderate income and moderate home prices that you're talking about?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we have served median income households of about $40,000. Which is about 50% of the area median income, and effectively below a level of, say, maybe 20,000 becomes very difficult to be able to sustain a mortgage payment. So we really are at the lower tier of those families that have the financial wherewithal to be able to be responsible, sustainable home buyers. Not sure if that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the value of the house when somebody is at that level, is it a $80,000 house, $120,000 house?
About $115,000 to $125,000.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Mulry, you have a question yet?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First of all, just a real quick question, and then I'll get into the other one. What do you use as the guideline on percentage of income that they can? Because I know that different federal programs use quite a bit different. I think there's, and then the private, some of them are different, anywhere from 38 or 30 to on up to, I've even seen 43. So.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, it really does depend on which agency program you're referring to. With our homelessness programs, we're really serving people well below 30% of median income. With
I was talking about what percentage, a guideline for how much they can pay of their income.
Debt to income ratio. I honestly don't yet know the answer to that question.
You can get that.
We can get that back
next
to you.
Question is, I thought I heard you saying down payment loans, and I remember at one point this is many years ago, you had programs where you loaned the mortgage, the down payment match, the closing costs and everything, and some of those programs did not have a very excellent record. There were a number of people who would get into them and just live there and not make the payments. Are you still doing those? I thought it sounded like you were still doing those.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, we do provide down payment assistance and closing cost assistance. That's primarily through two programs, the Homeownership Assistance Fund, which is state appropriations, and the federal home dollars. The assistance that's provided, let me back up. Every home buyer is required to make a contribution towards their down payment or closing costs. So there is always money from the home buyer on the table. As the commissioner mentioned, our foreclosure rate is about 50% lower than statewide Minnesota mortgage bankers average. So we're at 1%, and if you just look at the statewide average, it's about 3%. If you just looked at prime loans, which is what we do, it's 1.5%. So the performance on our mortgages is very good.
Representative Mulry, if you got any more questions, Ms. Orr would be glad to come to your office and get you some answers. And with that, thank you very much for being here. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.